Okay. I should just say that I'm starting to feel that sometimes you feel like when you go too deep into a sigya, you get dizzy and you forget where everything is. But now I feel that finally starting to hit the sweet spot in the sigya. Anybody feel that way? Or you guys on the other? I've been learning the sigya for like 4 years. And I must say that, like, I really think that I'm only starting to fully sort things out now. So things are starting to crystallize for me. You're probably thinking, wait a second, this is such a disaster. This is like a chillant where you can't figure out which piece falls where.
I mean, the new stuff today is just kind of blasted away.
Well?
The new, like, we're going to get to it. Like, the Nisibas by the Geneva stuff, they're just like, well, it's like a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, doing that, like, kind of like on the board, like, okay, some people think, all right, you're just a strong principle. It's under my, like, I feel like 20 backwards volleys.
There's a lot of flip-flopping here.
Yeah.
Agreed. So let me start. Let me make one. You guys are going to kill me. I'm just going to make one. I'm going to share one thought about the Hezekiah discussion about privacy. Don't shoot. But, I was just thinking about the idea of controlling how you present yourself to the world. Like part of the what makes privacy important. And having a room to yourself where you could decide what people see and don't see. Just something came up in conversation that struck me as very relevant. You often hear this with like people who are terminally ill or have severe dementia at the end of their lives, and they say, I don't want you to remember me as the sick person who is a drain on everybody else's resources and time. I want you to remember me as I was like in my prime. And you could think that's also relevant to the question of how you present yourself to the world. So I just think that's a good example to think about. You guys agree with that? Yeah. Okay, that's it. That's all I had to share about the going back in time. Okay, so number one for today. Sorry, where do we have the... I guess I can minimize this, right?
Okay.
So number one is the Avi Ezri that I mentioned on Sunday Shir. This is Rav Shach. I think this is a really beautiful piece. I was trolling you guys on the WhatsApp. Anybody, what did you guys think about it? So I actually really like this piece, and I think it opens up a third main approach to interpreting our sigya. The Avi Ezri himself might not think it's a third approach for reasons we'll see in a second, but we've seen the Bala Mor's Hezekiah approach to our discussion. We've seen the main Nehneh Yored approach to our sigya, and I think the Avi Ezri is a nice in-between view where it's Hilchos Shcheinim. So it's the law of partners, the laws of communities, not necessarily tethered to the fact, it's not a mechayiv that you benefited, it's not an unjust enrichment theory, and it's not a damage through sight, it's not an invasion of privacy, sigya, right? It's really about a collective action problem of zoning laws and working things out between partners. Right? So literally the law of neighbors, which I think is a nice third approach to our sigya. Do you guys agree with that? So I thought this is very fresh conceptual ground that he is offering us, which is really just delightful. Now, anybody's thoughts on that framing of where the Avi Ezri falls? We'll see more in a second as we get into it. Now, the Avi Ezri here is in Gimel Gimel and Hilchos Shcheinim. He points out that most Rishonim read our sugya through the lens of Yored, which is fine. And he runs into a problem. What's the big problem that he encounters with the Yored theory? Yeah, Eitan?
In the corner of the Rambam, it can't be, because without the corner of the Rambam, Yored, you can say she get off.
Yeah, perfect. Beautiful. We saw this discussion in the Rishonim. Why can't the beneficiary say Tol Eitz Chavavanecha, which is certainly a view in the Rishonim in Bava Metzia? We saw a camp like the Ramban, who's thought that right to say Tol Eitzcha is limited to a Sadeh She'enu Asu Yalita. So the sugya is not problematic for the Ramban, but it is problematic for the Rosh and what the Kesef Mishnah says to do the Ramban. Right? Why shouldn't the beneficiary be allowed to say to the Makif, take back the benefit that you conferred? Right? This is a problem that many Rishonim raised, many Poskim raised. And there's like two approaches when you're confronted with these problems, right? You guys familiar with, in philosophy of science, it's called the Duhem-Quine thesis. So it's like when you're doing scientific experimentation, you're always going to have these problems. Like there's a phenomenon that doesn't fit with the theory. So then you have to revise something to make it all work. So the Duhem-Quine thesis says you're always going to revert, you always want to modify like the thing that's going to do least damage to like your system of knowledge overall. Right? So okay, you say, okay, maybe the experiment got it wrong. Right? That's like a slight modification. So
yeah.
Then you redo the experiment again, you say, oh, the experiment seems to be good, so we have to modify some rule. So you, but you want to modify a rule that's not going to like wreak havoc to your conception of like the world in general, right? You know, you're not going to revise the laws of mathematics because you have like a weird phenomenon that you observe, right? You like change some like peripheral scientific theory. Does this sound reasonable to you guys? Mm-hmm. So you see that in Arsig, yeah? So there's a problem. There's a problem here. Why can't the Nika say Tol Eitzkav Avanecha? So some Rishon and Marcus say, oh, there's some like local technical explanation. And Rav Shach just goes for the jugular and says, oh, Arsig therefore can't be a bad man. That's, he goes to revise like the most fundamental thing at issue in the sugya, rather than what the other poskim do, which is revise like some local theory about when you could say Tol Eitzkav Avanecha. It's just an interesting thing. We'll see how different people go. So, yes, the main motivating point or piece of Rav Shach's analysis is this Tol Eitzkav Avanecha problem, and he cites the Kesef Mishnah and Hilchos Gzela Yud Hey. Who says, according to the Rambam, even if it's Asuyalita, you could say Tol, V'im Kain Kasha, Eich Efshar L'chayib L'hanikav, can you guys see this? Yomar Lo Tol. Okay, so this is the problem. So what does he say? And then he has a second observation. What's his second observation? This is also a nice observation. Scharia, what's his second Ha'ara? So the Tol, Eitzkav Avanecha problem is one issue. What's the second issue?
If the case of Makif is really a case of Yorid and Nehemiah, it should be included with the other ones. Zeylon, what's it doing over here? The Rambam again.
Yeah, there's a Rambam placement issue. Why does the Rambam codify these rules in Hilchos Shchenim? It should be in Hilchos Gzela where the Rambam codifies those rules. Now here you could just say, well, the Rambam doesn't really have a Hilchos Nehemiah. Even like the Gzela discussion is just an ad hoc placement. Which, like, maybe the Rambam doesn't view this as a sui generis category that deserves its own set of halachos, so the Rambam just disperses them throughout his different halachos, so you could have said that. But Rav Shach, you know, takes his principled position and said, no, Gzela is the Hana discussion. The fact that the Rambam codifies this in Hilchos Shchenim teaches us that the Mechayiv is not Hana based, but rather Shchenim based, like the rules for neighbors, the rules for neighborhoods, zoning laws, etc. And he says, Mishum kach, look at this phrase, Mukhrach lomar bidas harambam, shizeh udin mechudesh b'shchenim. If I was his editor, I would have told him to take out the word mukhrach, like, you're not forced to say that here. But that's fine. You know, if you want to give the analysis the facade of necessity, it's okay. And then he said, just like the Mishnah Rishona in Bava Basra is about Hezek Re'iyah, which itself is a subset of Hilchos Shchenim, according to Rav Shach. So I think this analysis is really good, and look how he characterizes this. He says, Shekachu adin b'shutfin v'shchenim, shetakana shnehem hi sheyivnu koso. What does that mean? That it's a takanas shchenim? Shetakanas shnehem? What does that phrase mean? How do you read that, Kobe? How do you read that phrase, the takanas shnehem?
They both really have to build a wall.
Well, what does takana here mean? Takanas shnehem?
They both have
just translate the phrase, takanas shnehem, so it's a... What does takana mean? You only translated one of those words.
Context.
What?
It's a rule for both of them.
So I guess you could say takana as a law, right? I don't think that's the way I would translate it here. Eitan?
Like the fix for both of them is
yeah.
Two.
The fix is another way. I think it's a little closer to what I would say. I would translate even slightly differently. I would say for the betterment of both of them. Right, like tikkun, like fix, But it's for the betterment of both of them that they should build a wall. Meaning it's like, overall, they both benefit by having this wall. V'takana hi shetiknu l'shchenim. And this is a takana that Chazal made for neighbors. Which I think is just a very nice way of formulating the notion of a zoning law type rule that we've discussed, right? Like the Jerusalem stone, it's better for the neighborhood to have this type of aesthetic. So to here, it's better for the Shutfin to have this wall. And so Chazal just institute this takana that as neighbors, they should both bear the costs. Good? Does everybody see how that's like a nice formulation of the Shechinim principle? Eitan, you have a hand on this?
Yeah, is it saying then that like without the wall there would be some kind of problem, or is this just a thing that makes it even better?
I think it's just that it makes it even better, right? Overall, society, the neighbors are better off with this wall. So it's not taking a strong view that there's a problem without it. But you could think, for example, of all these collective action problems in neighborhoods. Like one person has to reinstall piping. Like on the whole, like if he wants to fix his sewer, he's got it, like the whole street has to be fixed. And everybody benefits from him having to fix that, you know, sewage pipe. So everyone has to pitch in 50%. Just like a rule, right? To solve these collective action problems.
So that's just, like if someone has a desire to do it, then that then like requires everyone else to pitch in?
Yeah, so Rav Shach actually says that you could be mocha in advance and say, I'm not interested in bearing 50% of the cost, don't do it. But if you're not mocha in advance, then the law of the neighborhood principle kicks in that neighbors should bear the cost equally when they benefit equally. So it's not a chiyuv mitam nene. So for example, if a non-neighbor tried to impose this on you, you would have no liability. You wouldn't have to reimburse them. It's only because your shachin, who you share a property boundary with, did it, that you kind of are in it together as partners. So I think this is really just an excellent analysis. Okay, and then he says over here, it's like they're kind of just like locked into this problem. One person can only better his field by also bettering the neighbor's field. So like per force, you're conferring your neighbor benefits from your repair. So therefore, chayvu chachamim imlo micha betchila. Okay, and he says this is a chiyuv midine shchenim. Okay, you guys, good with that analysis? So I think this actually just sheds new light on a third interpretation of the sigya. Great. That's what I wanted to say on the Avi Ezri. Thoughts, comments, Ariel?
I'm just thinking. I guess it would be anathema, but we have precedent. If somebody was going to be your aid on a random person's field for the fence up, that's considered an unknown one, another you could be charged for it.
The Ramban thought so, right? He said if an Inish Me'alma came and built a fence, that would be Yukri Mechayev Mitam Hana. Rav Shach saying, no, this is a specific collective action problem amongst neighbors.
Yeah, but within the sheet of the Shach, what the Shach said, there could be a separate case of
Yukri. Rav Shach or?
Rav Shach.
Yeah. What do you say, what?
Did you say there's a separate case of Yor that could exist if somebody was Yor in a random sudden and put a fence up?
I don't think he's denying the principle of Yor in general, but whenever you're dealing with the principle of Yor, there's always a right to say Tol Eitzchav Avanecha, but not when it comes to Hilchos Shenim.
So the difference is whether or not you can say Tol Eitzchav.
Yeah, that's at least one nafkamina. That's the problem he's addressing over here. Yeah. Josh Hurt?
This, according to the Avi Ezri, this like, Takana Shtenim only kicks in for the fourth wall. Like, you don't have this Takana Shtenim for walls 1, 2, and 3.
I think he does. I think he thinks it would apply to. Actually, the question that he leaves us at the end seems to assume that it for sure would apply to walls 1, 2, and 3.
So even if we're just building one wall, we should share.
Exactly. As long as it's like on the boundary between your properties, you're in it together. You know, think of like neighbors in an apartment building. So one guy is redoing his wall, so you're just. By necessity, his improvements help the neighbor. So the law is neighbors work together. But not an external third party actor. Right? You don't know him anything.
Well, that's a pretty sizable fetish, right?
Which part?
That like if, you know, like I feel like Stan Bikov even saying you don't need a wall. In all these cases really you don't need a wall.
Yeah, he's just thinking it's like better for the property to have, you know, so you have to assume in order for his analysis to get off the ground that there is some advantage to the wall. It has to be a tikkun achatzer in whatever sense. But once you grant that premise, I think it's nice to say that neighbors have responsibilities to each other that you don't have towards a stranger. And tol etz chav avanecha is the nafkamina. Yeah. Josh Brofman, do you have a question?
Oh yeah, I was just going to bring up that point because I think at one point he says that there's like a kasha on his, like, why wouldn't it apply to the first two walls also? Like, I think he addresses that.
Yeah, at the end, at the very end. Yeah, exactly.
So I was going to say, like, I don't know, if we just lend in the Balamoris thing? Like,
yes, I wanted to say the Balamoris things also. I think the Balamor would work for to answer his question. I think that would be like an easy way to solve it. In my notes here, I said v'yesh li yashiv akushi b'sof l'fi Balamor. So I totally agree with you on that front. Great. Any other thoughts on the Aviezri? Okay. So let's move now. Let me just make one more. Let me just give one more thought on that. Sorry, how do I get the? I know how to do this. How do I get the table of contents here?
Go to view and show document online. Show
them. Okay, great. So I just wanted to just make sure. So I just wanted to reinforce the comment I made earlier, how Rav Shach thinks that you have to revise the whole mechayiv in our sugya based on the problem of tol etz chav avanecha, right? And I just wanted to point out that a lot of the poskim and achronim go in a very different way. So I thought I had this.
Links below with the parentheses.
So let's see. Here. Okay, so just to remind you guys of the local answers that the poskim gave to why you can't say tol etz chav avanecha in our sugya, according to the views that you generally could say that in a sada, even in a sada asui alita. Everybody with me? Yeah? So what were the answers? So the Shmuel Rozovsky said what? Anybody remember? What did he say? You could only say tol etz chav avanecha in general, in any case, when what? When what? Yeah, or like it's very reasonable that the guy would take it back, because then we think that your taina is true, like you're actually saying you don't want it. But if there's reason to not trust you, so like over here, you know that your neighbor is going to keep the wall for himself. So that takes all the oomph out of your taina of tol etz chav avanecha. Take it back. But you really are hedging that he's going to keep it. So that's like a local solution, right? It's a very narrow solution. So there's something about this case that explains why the taina lacks power. That's the Rav Shmuel's approach. Rav Shach's approach is to say, oh, that shows that our sugya does not mitam nene. So whereas Rav Shmuel is revising something within Hilchos Yored, Rav Shach wants to preserve the rules of Yored as they are and take our sugya out of the Yored discussion. So just two different approaches to that problem. The Chazon Ish in Siman Beis of Katan Chesem of Basra says that this is a local Takanas Chachamim. And this is, I think, not so different from what Rav Shmuel said about why you can't say tol etz chav in our case. Anybody want to just take a stab at what the Chazon Ish is saying here? He says, you can't say tol etz chav avanecha here, v'nir to Takanas Chachamim hu. It's just a takanas chachamim, so it's almost like an ad hoc policy rule. To deny the beneficiary the right to say toll. Why? Just because we know that people often lie to get out of having to pay for it. Okay? So this is, I think, similar to Rav Shmuel. So, but it's a practical concern. It's a blanket takanas chachamim to override the nene's right to reject the benefit just because of this harbe pamim nichalei v'yishtam et lo nichalei, this concern that he's going to lie. And this actually is going to cohere nicely with a pattern we've seen in our sugya. There's the underlying moral rights that the legal principle grants you. And then there are sometimes these policy considerations that override them. And you could see the Chazon Ish here seems to be saying, on a pure like rights basis of the rules of Yored, the Nana has the right to reject it. But policy-wise, it's too hard to discern when the Nana is lying, so we just take away that right. Now, really, that just kicks the conceptual question down the line, because then you say, why are we favoring the Yored over the Nana in policy? Right. So it doesn't solve the problem, but you see an interesting case again where the policy issue infringes upon the basic rights that the sugya allocates to the parties. Good? Okay. One final comment on this Tol Eitz Chavav Anecha right is the Nesivus view. The Nesivus is an equivalent Ches, Sifkat and Ches. He also is grappling with this question, why can't you say Tol Eitz Chavav Anecha? And he says the following. Hachanami Yomar Lo Afilu Lachar Shebana Tol Eitz Chavav Anecha. And he says this. V'nireh. Somebody want to read this? Anybody get a chance to prepare this, Nesivus? You probably did get a chance to prepare this. Eitans are not sure if you had a chance to prepare it, or... You did? Ah, so why didn't you raise your hand? Which of you wants to...
He's got it.
Okay, Eitan Jesselson, you're... Yeah, so this is interesting. It's very cryptic, doesn't flesh it out so much. But I think the fact that he says this case is different because it's like a partnership, I think that is very consistent with the Avi Ezri's analysis. Right? So what distinguishes our case from the Yored case is that the Yored case is just about conferring benefits. And there, when a third party confers a benefit on you, an external actor from the marketplace, you have a right to repudiate it, to say Tol Eitz Chavav Anecha. But when you're dealing with the laws of neighbors, so there's a different set of rules, he's like a shutaf, you know, it's tikkun hachatzer, it's like, you know, the Jerusalem stone, it's like the guy who's good for the neighborhood when your walk is shoveled, etc., etc. So that's why, since it's tova shnehem, they're kind of in it together as neighbors and shutfim, so the rule of toll does not apply. So I read this in the Sivis as being along the lines of the Avi Ezri's explanation, that our case is a shchenim. Shchenim and shutfim, let's say, are just two different words for the same idea, and that's why the claim of toll does not apply. Eitan, you have a follow-up?
How far you can take this? As an example, like, let's say you add something to your house, you raise the value of your house, but you're raising the value of all the houses in the area as well. Like, there also you pay for your neighbor's renovations?
Maybe. You're saying so the neighborhood price goes up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you see, I guess you didn't read Rabbi Levine's article yet, right? We'll talk, so yes, Rabbi Levine thinks that type of problem is actually what Yored is all about. Or so he says at the beginning of the article and at the end of the article. Whether the analysis in the middle sustains that, something we could discuss. But yeah, arguably, yes. Arguably, if you do make improvements to your house and that benefits everybody else, assuming that you don't need kavana lahanos everybody else, or maybe assuming in your case that you were mechavin lahanos everybody else, then yes, you would be entitled to collect. Yeah. Romy?
According to the Sivos or a bunch of these theories, I guess, why do you need hana? Like, why does it have to be hana if it's really just a shutzos?
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe you don't need hana. Maybe just tova shnehem is sufficient. I don't know exactly how tova shnehem comes together with the fact that you benefited. Sheshnehem tzrichim lahageder. I don't know if tzrichim lahageder is interchangeable with hana. Remember, Arsugin didn't mention Hana explicitly.
Right.
Right. And once you cut anchor from the Yorei discussion, maybe Hana is not as significant. Rav Shach did use the word Hana to explain it, but maybe that's not as crucial once you go into a Shechinim.
Right. I mean, I guess I was wondering why the Tova Shechinim didn't cry. I guess you don't listen to that Hana. Like, I'm trying to understand, according to these theories, what falls into the category of Shutfos and Shechinim.
Right, I'll say things for the mutual benefit of the partnership or the neighborhood.
Why? I mean, just because it's benefit me doesn't mean that I should be obligated to. And I mean, that brings back theory.
You just have to think of, like, a community has costs, and those costs have to be borne somehow.
Right, that's so if it's like, okay, we have both the responsibility to address certain issues, that makes sense, except in the way that things lie here. Like, why are we both in obligation to address this trend? Like, I don't want to.
Well, I think of it this way. If you and I went into business together and we had a real partnership, so we'd each bear 50% of the cost and reap 50% of the profits. Being neighbors is just a de facto type of partnership, right? You share certain things in the land and in the boundary, and so the costs of the shared neighborhood expenses just go to the two of you equally. Right.
I guess when I think about that, it's the same example. It's like, well, if you have a partnership in business, then one way to think about it is everything that happens should therefore be split in half. Or, like, you know, these majors can be split in half, and other things that you want to do are not. But, you know, kind of like going to a meal with people and what, you know, putting on.
You're saying that doesn't make sense.
No, I mean, like, I don't know. If we all eat this thing, then we should split that. But if you want to get something else that I don't really want,
it's tricky, right? You go out to eat with people, and then, we'll split it. And you're sitting there, and another person's ordering, like, fancy steak and wine, and you're like, wait, are we splitting that also?
I'm just kind of, I guess what I'm saying is once...
So, yeah, the point is, like, if it's in the background of a genuine partnership, then it's, right, 50-50 split.
Right, that
could
be a lot of technical meat, which is like, I'm in this because we have shared responsibilities, but all these other minor things fall into the category too, even though they're not really part of it. Like the things later in the paragraph about, you know, Beis Shar, like protecting the city, that makes sense.
But not a wall that benefits. So in an apartment, right? There's a wall dividing two rooms. That wall is like the Beis Shar and the Dallas, right? Like the neighbors have a common wall. That's how I think.
I guess if I'm mad, right. I guess it depends if you're imagining the inner fence or the outer fence. Maybe you're having a much harder time with the outer fence.
Right. Let's say I'm thinking about a wall that's, you know, it's in both of their, literally between on the boundary. Okay. Good. Everybody good? Okay. So now there are two ways we could get into the substance of today's discussion. Let me do it this way. I'm going to go for the conceptual presentation, and then I'll present how the particular sugya of Lokeach Migazlan fits into that, rather than start with the Lokeach Migazlan and then explain how it goes into the conceptual framework. So what I think one of the major themes that we started to break into in the last two shiurim is the relationship between the underlying core rights and obligations that arise from the principle of Yored and Nene and the policy / external principles that then infringe or limit the core rights allocated by Yored and Hana. So let me explain that a little better. You could think of, I'm not sure if I have a marker here. So we could think of the sugya allocating core rights to the different parties. I know it's a fraught question whether there are rights in halacha, but I'm just going to assume that right now. So you have to pay for a benefit, right? So let's just say Nene is chayav to pay. But then we have different types of issues that then limit the application of the core legal principle at work. So what are some examples of this, Josh?
That we don't want people going around doing really expensive work for other people.
Okay, good. So we have, right now I'm just going to say, I'm going to use this phrase, we have external considerations. Okay. We have external considerations, and what I want to say today is that the external considerations come in two varieties, and they're actually qualitatively different from each other. So one is, I would say, at the level of policy. Exactly as Josh said, the rule in halakha, so the fundamental right, is that the recipient of a benefit is entitled to be remunerated. Correct? But at the policy level, this creates perverse incentives. Okay? That's one type. So we have to limit the nanet rule. Then there's another type of external consideration. And here I actually think this is less external than the policy type consideration. So I'm going to use this phrase of equitable considerations. Anybody know what equitable considerations are? What are equitable considerations? I'm a little bit on the fence about whether these are actually external to the core rights. Equitable just means fairness, right? Fairness considerations. And so what do you take equitable considerations to be? A way of sharpening the distinction between Roman numeral 1 rights and Roman numeral 2b, just as a historical point, in English law, so there were courts of justice, they were like courts of law, and then the thought was that like the law sometimes is not precise enough, it doesn't really do justice in the right way to accommodate like the different varieties of cases that, so then they developed like courts of equity, where there's like courts that like, you know, had more like fairness considerations that were supposed to mitigate the harshness of the law or the categorical rules of the law that get applied too severely without nuance to different cases. So courts of equity had like much greater discretion in what types of punishments, what types of remedies they would give out, knossos, etc. So I think it's good to think of the equitable considerations as like distinct from like the core legal rights that are generated by yored, etc. So what type are, so I think that a second type of equitable, of external consideration in addition to policy, is fairness considerations. What would be an example of this? Yeah, Benji.
Maybe like unjust enrichment, or does that fall under rights?
I think unjust enrichment, you're right, it's an interesting question, where does that fall? But for our sake, certainly it's a rights question.
Maybe like building, you know, unreasonably large walls and forcing the other people to.
Yeah, for sure. That would be one type. But give me one example that we saw explicitly in our discussion. Take a minute. It's an interesting question. What falls under this category, actually? What do you think, Benji?
I'm not sure.
Okay, who wants to step in? Shmuel?
Maybe like the Zoll argument about like which type of wall you have to pay for, like the actual cost, the cheap material.
Yeah, the Zoll discussion in like the Rashbam or just in our Gemara? The Rashbam later on in Bava Basra or? What?
I think the Gemara's more primarily came up.
They did come up in the Gemara, the Meikhan and the Zoll, but remember the Rashbam in, I think it was Kuf Mem Vav that we saw on Sunday this year? Remember with the Sivlonos case, that the wife only has to, remember with the canceled engagement, she gets a 1/3 discount. Why? Because had she known that she would have had to remunerate, she wouldn't have eaten the stuff in the first place. So that's like almost like a fairness consideration, right? Yes, she did benefit the full amount, but hey, she wouldn't have wanted to benefit and pay. So in light of the Rashbam, the Zol and our Gemara to discount the Dmei Kanim from their market rate to a cheaper rate in light of the fact that the person didn't ask for it, I think is a kind of equitable consideration. You guys agree? Yeah? So let's flesh this out. So let me be a little... let me give another. What's another example of an equitable consideration? Sorry, you're...
I mean, I don't know. I think, like, Plotinus is like, you know, people will be able to easily get out of it, so stop people from getting out of it.
I think it's more policy, because, like, we're worried about liars, right? But I see.
Yeah,
you're saying it's
you,
fairness.
Like, sharpen that categories in a little bit more, while you're
okay.
Saying about policy and...
Yeah, okay, good. So let me sharpen them a little more. So... what I think falls under the policy category is exactly what number one is what Josh Brofman said, the Yad Ramah, about perverse incentives. Right? In a Yuri case, what did the Ramah say? We have to lower the amount he could recover, because otherwise everyone's going to be incentivized to confer benefits against people's will, and that's really bad policy. And that's a really bad result, so we lower compensation to remove perverse incentive. It's like in my kids' school, Oriente, if they wanted everybody, what was the rule? Oh yeah, if you get a positive COVID test, then all like the siblings of the kid have to stay home. Mm-hmm. Right, so everyone's like, okay, we're just not gonna test. Right, so that creates the rule creates a perverse incentive. So the school has to say, okay, so now everybody, like a low plug, everyone in the school has to get tested to remove that incentive for you to not test your kid, so that you don't have to keep your kids home. You guys see that? So this is something like that. So I think the Ramah is a great example. What's another example? I think the Baal HaMor. Which part of the Baal HaMor? So the Baal HaMor explains. Why should you have to pay to make Kanin Bezul? Because we want to incentivize you to work together with the Mika to determine what kind of wall you're going to build. Correct? So I think that's also a type of policy consideration. It's almost like a penalty. We're going to penalize you for acting unilaterally so as to incentivize you to work together with the Mika to determine what kind of wall is going to be built. Meaning, at the core level of rights, the Makif has the right to be compensated in full, kifi mashe gadar. But, Baal HaMor said, so as to incentivize a good collaboration between the Makif and Mika, we knas him to pay... to only recover to make Kanin Bezul. So I think that's a policy consideration to incentivize good collaboration. You guys agree? Yes? Okay. Number three, we're going to look at more closely in a few minutes. So we didn't see this example yet. But if you saw the Makoros on the Lokeach Min HaGazlan, so that discussion is somebody steals... Kobe's field. Somebody who's very hard to recover the field from, a non-Jew, an Anas. I go and recover it. So is and I pay the guy of the Gaza money. Is Kobe obligated to pay me for recovering his field? Now, some Rishonim say, the Rashba and the Ravid say, that the amount of compensation I'm entitled to receive is one thing under a pure perspective of rights. Under a pure perspective of rights, I'm entitled to recover the benefit that Kobe receives from getting his field back. So you do the analysis, how much would Kobe have paid to recover his field? That's how much I'm entitled to get from him, because I conferred a benefit of getting him his field back. Yes, Josh?
What?
Yeah. Yes or no?
Yeah.
But the Rishonim say it gets limited, that amount gets cut, in consideration of the fact that it was wrongful for me to buy a stolen field. Okay, it's like, I should not have purchased the field, I should have had Kobe, should have told him about it and allowed Kobe to recover it. So we penalize me for putting cash in the pocket of a Goslin. We'll see that in the Rishonim. But that's a point where we're distinguishing between the rights that I'm entitled to make or I didn't, and the policy consideration of penalizing somebody. We want to deter people from putting money in the pockets of Ganaven. Okay, so we cut down the rate that the purchaser is able to recover. So I'm just going to put it here, the Ganaven case. That's some of these. Is that more or less clear? Josh, do you have a question on that? Well, we're going to look at that case inside in a second.
Yeah, so I'll wait.
You wait? Okay. On the equity side, so I think there are just a few broad principles here that are relevant. So what about the fact of zeh neneh v'zeh lo chaser being pater? You might say, under the pure perspective of rights, as Romy insisted earlier on in the shirim, the neneh should have to pay because he received the benefit. But if you look at it from a fairness consideration, if the benefit came at no cost to the yore, to the mahane, well then, kind of this consideration of fairness, you kind of sit back in your armchair and you do some philosophizing about what it means for something to be fair, and you say, wait a second, it's not fair to impose the duty of remuneration on the beneficiary if it came at no cost to the conferrer, to the yore. Do you guys agree with that? So I think one way of thinking about zeh neneh v'zeh lo chaser is like as an equitable consideration. As an equitable consideration, supervening on or limiting the fundamental rights that the principle of yore confers. You guys agree with that suggestion at least? Yes? Benji, do you see that? Okay. Ezra, do you see that? Okay. Great. Ariel, you see that?
Yeah.
I wasn't talking about like whether you could see the board. I was asking whether conceptually is that.
I'm still not 100% sure. Like the equitable consideration you're saying is that it's a matter of fairness, just because otherwise it's not going to meaning because it's in the total cost. It's just a matter of like.
Well, why should I have to pay if it came at no cost to you? Right. I think it's a fair way. Right? Doesn't that sound fair? Right. Yes or no? You don't like the category of equitable considerations? Daniel, do you? Does this make sense?
No. Just in terms of like, to me it just seems like it's like one's kind of like dealing more directly with modern with like financial law than the game of the other. In terms of policy,
you're asking what's the difference between the policy and equitable?
Yeah, like one's like more directly related to like money, and one is more directly related to like actions, I guess, or like repeat.
Which one do you think is which?
Well, I think equitable consideration sounds like it's more related to like, do you have to pay back or like how much.
Well, let's do the rest of the examples. So, other equitable considerations that I think that I have on my list are. So remember the Yad Arma? Is that what you said?
The preemptive protest. Is that what
you mean? Maybe. Yes. Maybe like the preemptive protest. That's. Hold off on that thought for a second, because I think the preemptive protest might belong, like it might vitiate the claim for Hana altogether. So we could. There's a lot of different ways to map this out, but I was thinking the Yad Rama on. So his second way of distinguishing the sugi of Yore from Akif and Nika. Someone's like looking back into their head. What was the second way? Are you done?
That's what people don't go around building lots of things.
Well, that was the first one. That's the perverse incentive. The second distinction was the Shifas thing, right? That. At least the way we interpreted it in the last year is, since you're only paying 50%, it's okay to charge you the higher rate. Remember
that?
That
was the first
answer. Oh, that was the first answer. I'm sorry. Okay, my bad for confusing you all. And give you all enough credit. Correct. So yes, the first answer in the Adharma is that. So sorry, Dan, your response was correct. Is that since you're only paying for 50% of the wall, it's fair to charge you the higher rate of remuneration, as opposed to the your rate case, where you're paying for 100% of the benefit, so it's fairer to charge you a lower rate of compensation. Remember, this is under the empirical assumption that the Yadarma was under, that Kifima Shegadar is a more expensive rate than the shevach of the field, right? That was his assumption. we didn't like. So yeah. So I think this. So if you're only paying half, since you're only paying half, it makes sense to charge you a higher rate. Does that sound like an equitable consideration to you guys? Right, so it's like this. It's like a kind of like a loose fairness type of principle. Well, you like this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Right. So number three. Okay, so sorry, do you have a question on this, or?
This is clarifying what you mean, though.
Okay. Yeah. So I think this is helpful to clarify the distinction, but also to map out the sigma. Right, I think we're trying to get clear on all the different principles at work here. You see why it takes like 4 years to finally get clarity on this. You have to look at these sigmas at like different angles to appreciate what's going on. So we have other examples. Romy, you had a hand?
I don't know. I guess I just am a little bothered by the fact that equitable consideration should work against the beneficiary.
I think it depends, right? It really depends. He's getting such a good deal, so...
What if he doesn't want the deal?
What?
What if he doesn't want?
So that's... so that's...
I guess that maybe told is another...
Right, that's already built into the sigma already. And then those fundamental questions, the question of like, well, maybe that's at the level of rights already, right? I mean, you can't be... If at the level of right you can't be forced to take it, then that vitiates the underlying... What's unique about these considerations, to my mind, is that they grant that Roman numeral one rights is satisfied. Mm. Having granted that there's a right to remuneration, these equitable considerations limit it in some way. The points that you're raising, Romy, I think operate possibly at the level of one, where they deny that there's a right to remuneration given that maybe you didn't want it, right? It's against your property rights, against your autonomy, etc. So I think what's more interesting about this thing is external considerations mitigating the application of the right. Okay, anybody else have examples? So what other examples maybe of equitable considerations that limit the... Ellie Levy, you have a thought? Was that a yes, no, a grunt,
no.
Or no? Okay. Josh Brofman, and then Romy.
Can I just ask about this last one?
Sure.
Can you also look at it that, no, the higher rate is like the right of the guy. It's the guy's right to be paying at a higher rate. And the fact that the other guy only pays half is a lack of an equitable consideration on his side. Meaning when he has to pay 100%, we have an equitable consideration.
Yeah, you can reverse it. Right.
That's, I don't know, that seems
looking
like
at it from the Nikov side rather from the Makov
like,
side.
Like, I would say like it's more like the guy's right to pay the highest rate.
Yeah, well, exactly. You could look at it that way. Yes, you could definitely look at it that way. I thought the language in the Yadarma was more focused on why the Nikuf is burdened. But yes, since the one is, the Makif is coming at the expense of the Nikuf, they're two sides of the same coin. Yes, that's a really good point. Romy?
Maybe because of Rush and the wall.
Oh, the aesthetic consideration. Yeah, maybe.
You shouldn't have to pay...
Just because you forced me, that's interesting. I think that's along the lines of your point about not being forced to take something against your will.
Right.
But you're right.
I'm really hard to defend.
Yes. Scharia?
We mentioned in the discussion just to maybe like get them on the board, like the discussion, like the chazanish of bad policy of allowing people to just say
yes.
Just get them on there.
That might be a policy, right? Maybe the chazanish so if we could afford here. I thought it was niche about to get out, weed out liars, right? I agree, that's a good example.
I think you mentioned in the actual, like the Rashbam's Bezul. They were getting into this.
Yes, the Rashbam's Bezul, right? So this is, I guess, connected to Romy's point. If it's the kind of thing you wouldn't have accepted l'chadchila, knowing you had to pay, so then we cut it down b'dieved. So like, remember the woman who ate from the husband's gifts, Rashbam says you get a 1/3 discount even though you're paying the benefit because were you given the choice, you would have opted to not eat it, right? So there's like this point about because it's bal karcho, we give you a cheaper rate of compensation. So I think that Rashbam about Fizul is for sure an equitable consideration. What else? What else? Skara?
Maybe there's a question on Zul, maybe I'm like losing it. Like, isn't this explanation of our explanation of the Zoll and the Balamar's explanation of like the Moffat going ahead with a heel, like aren't they like really like sort of like just the opposite, like exact same thing just from the opposite perspective?
I don't think so.
Am I like making too many connections here? Like,
I think the Balamar is better understood as to incentivize collaboration.
Yeah.
So,
and the Zoll is given that we're never given an option to like enter this.
It would be unfair to charge you full market rate for something that we know you would have refused the Chathila.
So it's kind of like a similar principle underlying, like okay, things a group kind of like Chiyuvim that were entered like Baal Korfo without knowledge of both parties.
Yes.
They're
similar in those terms.
Yeah.
They're similar in those terms, but what's the rule doing? Is it creating a legal incentive to facilitate certain types of behavior? In which case, it's not about fairness, right? It's about, it's a stick. It's a financial incentive to make you act a certain way, as opposed to what's like a key moral consideration of like, what's a fair type of compensation rule? See that, Skara?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I distinguish between them. So, what else do we have here, guys, on our list? Anything? Now that you spend so much time with the Sugya, what do you... So, I have two more. So, on equitable considerations, I think the factor, arguably, of Kavana Lahashviach, maybe. So, what's Kavana Lashpiach? So, we only make the Nikaf or the Nene pay if the Makif had intention to confer a benefit. So, to my... So, are you guys familiar with that? Yeah, like the house flipper issue and the Shach issue. And the Nesivis, which we saw, said this explicitly. Let me get my... What did the Nesivis say in the last year? What was the Nesivis' position?
The reason why you're hired to Yori is because you had to put on Mashiach. But if not for that, Yori gets nothing.
Yes. That's a little too extreme. That might be at the level of...
Yeah.
Right. But a different Nesivis, actually. What was the Nesivis that we saw addressing the Yad Ramah issue about the different rates of compensation between Yoreda and Makif? Benji, is that a hand?
No.
No? Romy?
The rate of compensation depends on if he intends to be honest.
Yeah. Exactly right. So we had that in the Nesivis. Let's see if I could pull that up. Anybody remember which Nesivis this was? Let's see. You know, it's right next to the... It's in the discussion here that I...
It's on page 27, right before it.
Page 27. Right here. So he says, Davka biyorich alobirshus. Sorry. Here. Oh, yeah. So, amai machzir raka hutsa, hayelo liten gamken shevach. Deze eno, de davka biyorid lahashbiach adaita dechavre. When you improve someone's field with the intention of conferring a benefit, like in the Yored case, then you're entitled to recover the higher level of remuneration. But in the case of Makif and Nikaf, where you primarily act to benefit yourself, there you're not entitled to get the higher rate of compensation. Remember, Josh Brofman pointed out there's an empirical assumption here, opposite of the Adar Ma, about which rate is higher and which rate is lower. But for the Nesivis, the rate of compensation that you're entitled to is a function of whether you intended to confer a benefit. Right? So doesn't that strike you all as an equitable consideration, right? Maybe there's some reason to think that if you didn't intend to confer a benefit, then it's kind of strange to allow you to just be paid for something that you were a service you weren't intending to provide or to gain out of. Daniel, you have a...
Yeah, I'm still wondering, why is that like not under rights then? Why is it different from like maha?
Okay, so let me point out that I agree with you that this issue of did you intend to confer could fall under right, like vitiating the right, or under an external consideration. So I concede the point, like in the Shach, who said that there is no right to compensation when you didn't intend to confer the benefit, that would enter at the level of vitiating the right. It would deny that Roman numeral 1 applies if you're a shach person, that there's no din of yorid when you were niskaven lehanos. But I'm just looking here at the nesivis, who lowers the rate of compensation. Right? The nesivis says how much you get remunerated is a function of what your intention was. Right? Do you just recover your costs, or do you get the higher increase in value to the property? And the nesivis says, well, that rate of compensation is going to be affected by your underlying intention.
What about Machab, right? Whether you get compensated at all, it also depends whether the guy protested from the beginning.
So Machab might enter at the level of rights. Right? When you're Moche, I think that's what I was discussing with Romy before. That could either be undercutting the right or an external consideration of fairness, like maybe it's not fair to hold people to have to remunerate when they explicitly told you not to. Or better yet, if the yored acted after being warned that this is not something that the nene wants, it would be inequitable to allow him to gain from that. Right? He acted in bad faith, it would be inequitable to allow him to be compensated.
Right.
So that I agree, that could be a principle of equity, for sure. Yeah, formulated that way.
Fine.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, let's try
it. I think, like, just based off the later disciples and the Conan, like buying stolen goods, where he appeals to this and saying, "Oh, and therefore,
no
since,
compensation.
Since this buyer was trying to buy it for himself to get some, like, you know, some cheap goods off this sketchy seller, he has no right to get paid at all." Since he said, like, when he was like, "That would be yoreh shlober shoshai mitam shenstam nashvia avolav pachi pach." So, like, he's, I mean, like, I don't know, maybe just inconsistent with this and see.
Yeah, I think it's. I want to point out there's a stira in nesivis.
Okay.
Yeah. I agree that nesivis is closer to the shach.
Yeah.
That it vitiates the underlying right in that case, not just as an external consideration of fairness. Yeah. But I think this nesivis,
yeah,
about the rate of compensation works nicely. Like, hey, it makes sense to lower the rate of compensation if you weren't even intending to benefit from this. Yeah. Okay. Zuldi, do you have a thought or...
So,
what's that funny?
No, it's
all good. Sure, you want to share with us? Or making fun of my list over here? It's bored you to death?
No, it's not boring at all. But I don't know, I just find it the macha versus, you know, I'm still hung up on it.
Which part of it?
I just found it, I don't know, I'm a little arbitrary where what you consider rights, such as ego considerations.
Yeah,
so not, so, I don't know, it doesn't seem, it's not supposed to be exactly where my iceberg is.
It's not?
Like, clear to me still, like, what lies, what falls
in the wrong
category.
Okay.
I understand policy versus ethical considerations. I'm not sure why, like, give between ethical considerations and rights.
In the as first in, place?
Yeah, like, is it just, like, for example, like, the rate of compensation, or is it the existence of rate of compensation, or is it, like...
No, I don't think it's the... So... Anybody sympathetic to Daniel's point? It's fine if everybody raises their hands, that's okay too. Kobe's like, hey, I should raise my hand, and it seems a little arbitrary. Yeah, sorry.
I think we saw a lot of different mahal approaches. Like, I think the Ramban was just like in a corner. Just like, how could it be? Like, it doesn't even make sense that, like, you can't have him with a chila, but you can get after the fact. So it must be, you know, Eshar, you can just be Mocha. Like, it sounded kind of felt like the Ramban pulled it out of a hat. Therefore, like, I don't know. So, like, we would
go to manage,
at least. Like, there are
sheetos,
but you
macha
is just like,
yeah,
it just gotta be.
So, I don't have macha up here.
Yeah.
No, right.
I don't have macha up here. I think it's tricky. And right? The same way I don't have totally sabah on macha up here. I think it's tricky. And I agree that the nesivis issue about niskaving to confer the benefit actually, as Sakari points out, will depend on which nasivas you look at, right? In some cases, the point is that the basis for being remunerated is that you intended to confer a benefit. Maybe that would throw Sakari's quasi-contract perspective that he mentioned in the last year. But I also think that it certainly can enter at the level of an external consideration that is limiting the rights under Nana. Right? And my thought is that if it's lowering the rate of compensation, it seems to be, in principle, you're entitled to 100%. But if that amount is lowered by the equitable consideration, that you weren't intending to confer the benefit. That's how I see it. Now, do you guys agree with Zilti that there's no difference between... So let me just distinguish between two different things that Zilti could be saying. One is, I don't really understand the difference between these three categories. The fundamental rights level, the external consideration of policy, and the external consideration of equity. That's one way of saying what Zilti's saying. A different way of saying what Zilti's saying is, I think that what falls where is a little arbitrary, or I don't agree with your analysis of what falls where. Zilti, which one of the two were you going for?
I don't know if the way I'm confused, so usually, like, if you want to categorize different things, right, like, the way I like to think of it is, like, there's usually, like, a certain template that you kind of follow, and, like, based on, like, if it follows this rule, then we can categorize it over here. So if this rule, categorize it over here, right? So I'm just not clear, like...
What the rule is
in terms for each one of these. Right? I don't know, like, it's just, like... For example, are we saying that, like, rights, for, like, just a category one for rights, are we saying that that is just... there's a general rule that, you know, if you did work for someone else's field, you're supposed to get compensated. So therefore, we assume that you anything to do with, like, full compensation for doing work at someone else's field.
So I don't have a strong view on that. Meaning, I don't have the necessary and sufficient conditions that would tell us what constitutes the fundamental rule, what constitutes a policy consideration, and what constitutes an equitable consideration. But my point is, do you see the conceptual difference between this, and this?
Yeah.
Okay, right? So you agree that there's a conceptual distinction between what's the core right that the halacha confers upon you?
Yeah.
A right to be compensated when you confer a benefit, a duty to pay when you receive a benefit, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's the question of, well, sometimes when you apply these rights, they create... perverse incentives, or they create collaboration problems. So we need to tinker with the incentives in certain cases. That's the idea of policy. And then there's the idea of equitable considerations, which is there are external values of fairness that will infringe on the application of this core set of rights. Are you in agreement with that?
Yeah, that's what I'm totally in agreement with. It's just like, for example, like there's the like the gray, like the, I don't know, like the topics, like the gray concepts, like you kind of fall under like those categories.
But that's fine, right? And that's I think it's we don't need to have a perfect classification of everything.
Okay, so
right?
That bothers me a little bit. But yeah. It's fine.
Can't solve all the world's problems at once. I agree that some of these might be controversial classifications, and we can't classify all of them. But I don't think that undercuts the significance of understanding which factor enters the sugya at which level.
I don't know.
The gray areas, or. You guys all sympathetic with Zilti, or no? Josh, are you like, what's this guy talking about? Yeah?
I'll explain it to him after shooting.
Yeah, all right. Josh will take you outside and he'll explain to you everything.
Oh, yeah, I look forward to it.
Great. Let me mention one other principle here. So that is the principle of how much effort did the benefit confer expend in conferring the benefit? So did you guys see this discussion in the Meiri about the olive trees that get uprooted and then get planted in somebody else's field? So Kobe, tell us about that.
Yeah, basically, there's like a, I guess there's like a flood of some sort, and your trees get washed away, and they leave, like they lose, like they move, like someone else's field. So the discussion talks about like for the, how many, like who has to pay for what, like you guys share the profit of it.
Exactly. Yeah, and so the sugya comes down saying, basically, that if my olive tree gets uprooted and planted in your field, to make a very long story short, I don't get the yored compensation amount of the net margin, the marginal increase in value to your field, right? So had I gone into your field and planted the tree, I would get the maybe the yado ha'olyona rate, the market value improvement of your field. The Gemara doesn't say that. When the wind takes it or the storm takes it and plants it on its own, you get a lower rate. You kind of just get like the cost of your tree or something. So why is that? What does the Meiri say? The Meiri on Daf Kuf?
We finished up the last line.
You can be vain, done in Osa. So what's the distinction? What's the distinction?
Shebisadeha asuya lit. You would pay for like the work that you have to do, like all the work for all the parts of like the land you have like improved land. Oh, the zoo will talk boom. You didn't like do any work, didn't show you. You didn't do any work in this case, so the grain is washed away, so why should you get paid any like amount of money? Why should you get paid for your work?
Yeah. Right? So if I went and were to plant the tree, I would get this higher rate of compensation. But since the wind did it all for me, I can only recover this basic demand of tios. And the Meiri says, because you weren't toreach, bezu lo tarach klum, and that's why you're not entitled to the higher rate. Now, Romy might say, who cares, right? The nene benefited. He's paying for the benefit. He benefited from the property of the Baal Hazesim. So why not treat this as a classic Yored case? Right? It's not like we're compensating the Yored for his trouble. We're not compensating him for his tircha. It's that when there's tircha, he's entitled to the higher rate of remuneration. So why does tircha enter the sugya at all? Right? So Zilti, what do you think the answer is? Okay, you want to reduce this to the kavana? That's fine, other than that it's contrary to the words that the Meiri employs in interpreting the principle. What?
I didn't look inside.
This Meiri right here on the board, which Kobe read for us so nicely. Kobe, would you say that this is a principle of kavana? Let's say you said a l'shem yichud kud shebrichu when the hurricane came. That you want the hurricane to uproot the zeisim and plant it in your neighbor's field. Kobe, do you think that would bear on the...
No,
because it's not about your kavana. What's it about here?
Your tircha, how much work you do.
Yeah, your tircha, right? And the Ravid and the Shita Gwetzir says the same thing. So to my mind, that's another equitable principle. You know, similar, a little different from Zenen of Zechaser, but the point is that... what rate of compensation we entitle the yored to might be a function of how much tircha he expended in conferring the benefit, right? Even though nobody thinks that you're compensating him for the tircha, right? But you can see how that's like a reasonable, equitable consideration, right? How much effort and difficulty did he go through in conferring this upon you? All right, everybody good with that? Excellent. Thoughts, comments, anybody else subversive in not liking this conceptual layout of the sugya, Romy?
Because once you say that we care about his effort, then it like does change
what, like, the what the person's right, what the original principle is in the beginning, doesn't it? How does it not? Like, if it was really the fundamental right, then...
Remember, here it's just the rate, right? Because you're still collecting the demandization, arguably.
Right.
So, at least one reading of that discussion is that you're still a yo-rate who gets remunerated for conferring a benefit, just at a lower rate that's a function of how much effort you put in. So Zilti's like, well, now you're just saying that something's an equitable consideration if it's tethered to the rate of compensation as opposed to the fact of compensation, right? And I'm saying, no. I think it's just easier to call something an equitable... It's easier to appreciate that it's just an equitable consideration if... Because that shows you there's still a basis for compensation. It's just mitigated by... It's offset by some external consideration. But I agree that it could offset it to zero in certain cases. And that's still an external consideration. Just it's much harder to divine then what's external and what's internal. Right? If the rate goes down to zero. Do you see that? That's just my thought. Do you see what I'm saying? That's why these examples mostly come from the rate of compensation. Even though it's perfectly possible that under your rate, you're entitled to full remuneration. But then, there's some equitable external consideration that then just knocks it down to zero because it would be like so unfair to allow you to be compensated in that case. But then it's hard to know like what's a function of a full knockout between one and two, and what's just a denial of the application of one, right? In the cases where the rate goes down, where the compensation goes down to zero. My thought is that when you're simply limiting the compensation, it's kind of obvious that this applies, it's just being limited by this. Okay? So I'll tease that.
Yeah, it makes sense. That's why if you want to say like that class of case of Mover is that it's fundamental rule.
It might be, I don't know. Right? It might be that there's no basis of compensation in Macha, or there is a basis, it would just be so inequitable to allow somebody to be paid when they act in bad faith against the instructions of the property owner. So, two then just fully squashes one. As opposed to saying that there's no such right in that case, something like that. Okay? It gets too abstract if we get into the Macha cases. Romy, did you have a...
Yeah, I don't know. It seems weird to me that because what you're basically saying is the person has a fundamental right to, or fundamentally, if you had get a benefit, you should pay someone. But we're going to then consider it unfair if you pay them too much because they didn't really work hard enough for it.
Yeah, why don't you like that?
Because like, well, if I'm already telling you that the fact...
I should just say there's a class of people out there who don't like equitable principles. They just sound as like hand wavy and too loose and like what does that mean, right? I think you're falling into that.
I like equitable principles.
They're just saying, what does it mean that it's just somewhat mitigated?
No, I actually think that it's not into this particular one that is bothering me now.
Okay.
So why
the cheerful one.
Yeah. Why would you say that if a person has a if the fundamental rule is that you benefit, then that's like unjust enrichment or somehow unfair, then why should we suddenly care about the amount of effort that was put in? If the original principle is that you're benefited, then why would we lower the amount just because I put in less effort? It makes a little bit of sense the other way, say you have to pay more because you put in more effort maybe, but if the core principle is that you need to pay when you get something, then okay, you need to pay when you get something. You need to pay when someone puts in effort. That wasn't the core principle.
Josh, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you have the same problem with Zen and Nem is low cluster then? Wouldn't that be like pretty much the same thing? Zen and Nem is low cluster is also like the guy benefited, but like we're saying like, why should
no, because I can argue that it's not unjust enrichment if nobody lost at all. But
well, that's a way of saying that one doesn't apply then, right? Is that your way of saying that there's no right in that case?
No.
Okay, so then why not just say if you think one does apply in your response to Josh, then just say, Josh could say, well, Tirka's a kind of chaser, right? How much is he chaser? Right? So it's not, if he had no Tirka, right? So then what is he really being compensated? Like, it's, there's no reason why he should...
So maybe I would say that. All right.
Okay, this is I think, a very helpful structure for thinking about the different issues at work in this sugya. I'm actually going to triage here and just point you to, I'm not going to go through this makoros in any great detail, but I just want to point you to the Bava Kamma and Ches Tosfos. That's a discussion about when I purchase a field that was stolen. So is the owner obligated to reimburse? So I didn't know it was stolen, let's say, and I wasn't intending to purchase it for you. I was buying it for myself. But then it goes back to the true owner, because karka in an exelus. Does everybody have a... Who prepared this case? Raise your hand if you prepared this case. Okay, so you all know what I'm talking about? Yes? So Rabbeinu Gershom said, the owner, when he recovers it from the purchaser, has to compensate him. Right, and you can see the Re even uses this phrase of notel mashehe neyu. So it's like a yore type theory. The buyer off the Goslin is now benefiting the Balakarka by recovering it for him. Just the Rush in Vav Zayin and Bava Kamma is an interesting formulation. He says, how much the buyer can recover is a function of whether he was mechavein letovas the Baal HaKarka. If he bought it for the Baal HaKarka to redeem the property, then he gets a higher rate of compensation. But if he just bought it for himself, then he gets a lower rate of compensation. That's very consistent with the Nesivis in our sugya about Makif and Nikaf versus Yorid, that the rate of compensation depends on whether you're mechavein letovas the beneficiary. Okay. To my mind, that fits nicely as an equitable consideration, right? How much you get remunerated is going to be impacted by whether you're acting in good faith to confer a benefit or whether you're primarily acting selfishly. The second major point that I wanted to take out of that sugya is the discussion in the Ritva and the Rashba, who say they're pretty explicit that me'ikar adin, when you buy back this field, you should be entitled to a higher rate of compensation. But as a knas, they use that language explicitly as a knas, to deter people from buying property from thieves, so that thieves shouldn't benefit, we strip down the rate of compensation to a lower rate. That you get explicitly in the Rashba, and this Ritva here in the Rashba Bava Kamma and the Ritva Bava Metzia. So to my mind, that's clearly a policy consideration that I was mentioning here. In order to deter Ganavim through limiting the market of people who will buy products from Ganavim. Okay? So these are clearly applications of the Yorid principle, but filtered through the second principle, the external consideration of policy. Everybody clear on that? Okay, great. So, that brings us in our last few minutes. So I think we covered pretty much everything I wanted to cover so far. Excellent, 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 excellent. To the last discussion, Rishona, Shnia, and Shlishis. And I'm thinking, just for simplicity's sake, I think we should do our review of the Yorid principles on Thursday, synthesize, and maybe treat Kan Dina and Hadar Dina as a little bit of a sui generis discussion on its own after we do that, because it is a little bit independent. What do you guys think? Unless, yeah, Romy, you like that? Because it's kind of a separate discussion. Kobe, you disagree with your Harusa, or
no.
You're good with that? Okay. So let's just get the main issue out here in Rishona Shnia Shlishis, Dalet Amud Beis. The Gemara has a different view about the machlokas between Tanakama and Rabbi Yossi. The Gemara says, maybe according to the Tanakama, Rishona Shnia Shlishis Ika Beinayu, Tanakama Savar, Revi Yishu De Yoyevle, Val Rishona Shnia Shlishis Lo Yoyevle. Maybe when the Makif builds wall 1, 2, and 3, he doesn't have to pay, and it's only when wall 4 is built that the Nikah pays for wall 4. The Nikah never has to pay for the first three, And Ariosi disagrees. Ariosi says, once Wall 4 is built, doesn't matter by whom, then Nikov has to pay for all four. Correct? There are three approaches in the Rishonim about how to understand this case. Why should you distinguish between walls 1, 2, and 3? What are the three approaches in the Rishonim? Three approaches in the Rishonim? Only raise your hand if you know all three. All or nothing. We'll make this easier. Oskar, you know all three? Okay, double or nothing. Let's hear. All right, so start with the Ramban.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, start with
Ramban.
Yeah, Ramban and Mohamed. What's his view?
So, Mohamed's view explicitly that it's not about Kamkina, rather, it's about kind of like Kavana Rashbiya, but not from Rashbiya.
Exactly.
The first three, he's just doing it for himself. The fact he pauses after three shows it's just himself, and therefore, there's implicit Kavila.
Perfect. For the Ramban, this is just an application of his rule of Yored requiring Kavana Lahashpiach, right? Intent to confer the benefit on the other party. Ramban says, if you just build walls 1, 2, and 3, it's clear that your Kavana is for yourself, and it's only wall 4 that would show that it's Kavana for the Nikov, correct? Walls 1, 2, and 3, you acted for yourself. It's only on wall 4 that you also acted to confer a benefit on him. Remember, the underlying principle for the Ramban is Mechila. But if you're acting primarily for yourself, you're mochel on recovering from the other party. I would just point out that that's slightly different from the equitable consideration formulation of kavana to confer a benefit. That's not a principle of machila. That seems to be just a fairness consideration that once you're acting for yourself, it's not fair to impose the cost on the third party. But good, so that's one. That's the Ramban's approach. Everybody agree with Zachariah's reading of the Ramban? Excellent. Okay, so one down. Tell us Rabbeinu Yonah's approach. Rabbeinu Yonah's approach is very cool.
Which Rabbeinu Yonah? Based
on? Rabbeinu Yonah in his own view, not quoting Rashi.
Yeah, so...
Radical view.
Yeah, so he says that it's all my focus on Zenon and Zedul.
Which is crazy, right? Because you notice how all these Rishonim, this is why Gemara is so difficult. One of the reasons why Gemara is so difficult, put aside the Aramaic and all the other issues. It's because there's such a wide range of disagreement about what legal issue is at work here. So according to the Ramban, it's about Kavana to confer a benefit. According to the Rabbeinu Yonah, the Tanayim and the Mishnah are actually debating whether Zen Nena and Zel Lo Chaser is Chai or Pater. Right?
Yeah.
Which is wild. Right, so he reads into Rabbi Yossi that Zenena Vizel Lo Chaser is Chayiv. Which is pretty crazy because we possibly like Rabbi Yossi, I think, according to the Gemara. Right? So, the Rabbeinu Yonah thinks, Machlokas is Zenena Vizel Lo Chaser Chayiv or Pater. How does that work on whether you're Chayiv for all four or just the last one?
The first three walls are considered not a Chaser for the rest of the Nikah. Well, the fourth wall is considered clearly a Chaser.
Right. He thinks, when you draw the diagram, it's just empirically true that the Makif is not chaser when he builds the first three walls. He's only chaser on the last wall. So he says, whether you're mechayev the nika for walls 1, 2, and 3 will depend on whether you hold zenena vizet lo chaser is chayev. Rabbi Yossi, who says the nika is chayev for the first three in addition to the fourth, holds zenena vizet lo chaser chayev. Tanakama holds Zen and Avzelo Chaser is Pater. Right? So it's not conceptually rich. It's just an application of Zen and Avzelo Chaser principle. But it's super interesting that he interprets the Machlokas in our Mishnah as being a Machlokas about Zen and Avzelo Chaser. Okay, so that's approach number two. Everybody see that in the Adarma? In the Elios Rabbeinu Yonah? Yeah. Good. I think the most interesting analysis here comes out of Rashi and the Baal HaMor. What are they arguing about?
This principle of called the Kamdina and other Dina, which means if there's a kind of like a basin case and a psalm, we'll say on the earlier state, in this case, just the first three walls, and it comes and they declare Pater, and then he goes to the fourth wall, and he goes to basic again. We sort of like relitigate or reframe those first three walls in light of the fourth wall, or we say, no, Kamdina, the original stock stands, and we can't, like, no double jeopardy kind of thing.
Yeah, very tricky issue. So the thought is, sounds like everybody agrees that the Nikuf is benefiting at the end of the day from all four walls. Retroactively, he benefits from all of them. Correct? The question is whether does the procedural fact that there was already adjudication on walls 1, 2, and 3, does that bar us, does that stop us, does that e-stop us from going back and undoing the decision on walls 1, 2, and 3? Sometimes this is called res judicata, like it's already been adjudicated, you can't re-adjudicate it. You can't re-adjudicate it, right? So we're not going to overturn a decision that's already in place. That's the cum dina perspective. Now, what do you guys make of that perspective? What kind of rule is that? How do we explain cum dina? Josh?
I think you'd probably say one of two things. It'd be like fundamental, like when Beit Din makes a psak, it's like, you know, the MS said like you can't change it, or you can be like, we don't want Beit Din flip-flopping all over the place. You know, that can be...
Okay, so one thing is to say that this flows, let's just say, from... I'm not even going to go for the first formulation.
I like that one.
Like that. I think it was kind of Wasserman said something along those lines.
Oh, no.
It's a little too highfalutin for us right now.
Okay.
Even though I think it's a perfectly valid approach. But let's stay simple for a moment. Then we can get into the high seas of metaphysics. So one approach here is to say that it truly flows from like the procedural fact that it's been adjudicated, there's a value in legal stability, we don't want to overturn court decisions. So from a substantive perspective, applying the core fundamental rule of Nene, you should have to pay for all four walls. But there are some external considerations. Let's just call this policy right now, even. There's a value in legal stability. You want that when a court case is decided, you want it to be stable and be predictable. Whereas if you could always just overturn the court ruling, it kind of creates chaos and uncertainty and destabilizes the system. You guys see that? This would actually fit nicely into the framework of the core right in the Sigya, but it's blocked by this almost policy consideration that we want the law to be stable, or you want court decisions to be stable and firm. Yes? Agreed? There's another way to approach this. So it's not about legal, it's not the procedural fact that the claim has already been adjudicated, but it's a different point. That what? I think this language has some support in the Yad Armah, which we'll look at more closely. Notice what he says here. He also talks in these terms, and he says, "Dekasavar Tanakama kiven de yatza alein zakai sulo mitstarfi revius." What do you think he's getting at here? Sulo mitstarfi revius. So the fourth wall doesn't bind to the earlier walls. Josh, what do you think he's getting at?
I was going to say, yeah. Once you've already dealt with the three walls, now you have three walls and one wall, which doesn't turn into the case of Mishnah, which is about adding two other walls.
So say it a little more. Yeah, say it again.
Once you've already adjudicated the three walls, it comes into a separate category. You have these three walls that are adjudicated and this new one, and you can't combine them.
Yeah, that's great. Do you guys understand what Josh is saying? So what Josh is suggesting is that really what's motivating us is not the procedural fact that Beis Din, it's not court procedure that's motivating us. It's not a desire to make the law stable. Rather, so actually use this paradigm, it's actually a question of whether we have a fundamental rights-based case for benefit on walls 1, 2, and 3. Why wouldn't we have a Roman numeral 1 case? Because Hana has got to be individuated into discrete quanta, right? What Hana did you receive? So if we could look at all these walls together, then okay, you benefited from all four of them. But the fact that there was already litigation on walls 1, 2, and 3 just means that now we're going to look at Hana from wall number 4 as its own entity. We individuate it as its own legal question. And from the perspective of this wall, there was no Hana. So from the legal question before us now, we're asking only about this wall. We're not asking about Hana from walls 1, 2, and 3. Maybe that's a little too abstract. So can we reformulate that a little better? So the point here is that there's a certain window of time for asking about whether somebody received Hana. Okay? And when we ask the question on walls 1, 2, and 3, the answer is he did not receive Hana, because at the time when that question was relevant, the answer is no, he's not benefiting. Now, we're only asking about wall number 4, and from the perspective, and the question of wall 1, 2, and 3 never even arises. Right? So we're addressing the Hana question separately. So the point is that we're not motivated by the stability of court decisions. That's not what's motivating us. It's really just the question of which Hana are we focused on right now? And there's some background facts, the fact of prior litigation, that suggests we should only look at the Hana of wall number 4. So basically the difference between those two views? It's okay to say no. Does everybody see the result?
Just to clarify, going to court after the first three walls, it's an effect, according to the second view, it's just an effect to mark off the now separating the two different times.
Exactly. And I want to say something even stronger. And I think that's, by the way, the language of the Yad Arma, that it's just a question of whether can we sit this Hana of wall number 4 back to the Hana of walls 1, 2, and 3? And the point here is that no. There's because this is treated separately in time, we're not going to connect the wall 4 to wall 1, 2, and 3. Let me give you a clear nafkamina for thinking about the difference between stability versus number 2. Suppose there never was litigation. Right? There never was an actual court decision. It's just that you ask yourself this theoretical question, which is, were you to have litigated on walls 1, 2, and 3, let's say, within the first bunch of years, what would the outcome of that decision be? You weren't then. Now, the only issue before us is wall number 4. Right? So you may not even need actual litigation or SOC if you're looking at it from the perspective of just individuating the Hana of the fourth wall from walls 1, 2, and 3. Whereas if you're interested in the stability of the wall, arguably you actually need a psak bezdin. In our sugya, a lot of the Rishonim here seem to focus on what? Do you need an actual psak bezdin? Seems like it, right? Rashi uses that formulation, kvar yatza zakai bebezdin, kvar yatza zakai bebezdin, etc. If you look at the ritva and yivamos, which we'll look at when we discuss kamdina and hadardina separately, the Ritva actually thinks, in that sugya, it's an open question whether you actually needed a court decision. Really what's important is the theoretical question, had you litigated, what would a Bezdin have said at the time? So it's not about the actual stability or enforcement of a decision, but just about treating claims individually at the time that they're made. Okay, is everybody, is that helpful? So it's almost like the procedural question of kam dina hadar dina is just a theoretical lens through which to try to break up and individuate hanas. Okay. We'll stop here. From my perspective, I think we did a very good job sifting through all the different dimensions of the Yoreh discussion. I think so that there's no widespread sheer rebellion and revolt, maybe we should synthesize the sugya on Thursday. You guys could have Wednesday also to do some chazara. And then we'll treat kam dina hadar dina through the sugya of Yevamos and Machlokas Balamor and Ramban there as its own little discussion. And then do runya right after that. Is that any objections to that policy? Okay. Anybody, everyone good to do synthesize this material on Thursday? Okay, great. Sure, guys. Excellent. Great discussion today.